And many Hong Kong people believe that this ban is quite political.
Tiananmen Square remembered. It's June 4th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, violent protests over police killing continue. Protests extend worldwide, including Australia, and much more on today's VOA Asia. Today marks the 31st anniversary of the Chinese Communist leadership's bloody crackdown on student-led protests in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. Each year, Hong Kong residents observe the anniversary, but this year the government has banned such gatherings. VOA's Steve Miller spoke with local journalist Rhea Mogul to learn how people reacted to that decision.
Yeah, so, you know, they announced a couple of days ago that for the first time in 30 years, the June 4th vigil in Victoria Park would not go ahead. And of course, they cited the reason for this was because of social distancing and because we're still under social distancing rules. But many people, in fact, all democracy activists and many Hong Kong people believe that this ban is quite political. They see it as a way of clamping down on what they think is an expression of their freedom, of their rights. You know, the organizers of the vigil said that they were confident that Hong Kongers would adhere to social distancing rules and gather in groups of eight in Victoria Park. Now, bear in mind, Victoria Park is huge. It's massive. There's, you know, several football pitches, and it can hold a capacity of, last year there were about 180,000 people. So they were confident that people would camp out in little groups of eight and, you know, keep to social distancing rules. And when the announcement came that the march would not be allowed to go ahead at all, people were very angry.
So if people can't meet physically, are they still planning to observe the vigil?
Yeah. So the organizers of the event are still going to gather in Victoria Park in groups of eight. And there's not many organizers. So what they're going to do is they're going to be present at Victoria Park, and they're going to live stream to, you know, whoever wants to join the online vigil, and people will be in their homes and light candles. There's also several pop-up events that I've seen on Facebook for things like readings, literary readings, where people read, you know, Chinese literature and work from activists on the mainland. So there's definitely several events happening around Hong Kong. There's going to be a lot of online activism, and I imagine people will show up to Victoria Park anyway, because we're not banned from going to public places. It's just that you have to be within groups of eight.
There's much more on our website at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia Twitter, and YouTube. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. U.S. to bar Air China planes from entering country. Philippines reinstates pact with U.S. military. Britain offers Hong Kongers path to citizenship. COVID-19 infections rise nearly 500% in Pakistan. Mumbai escapes wrath of cyclone that pummeled India's west coast. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also stop by our voanews.com website. The pro-democracy demonstrations of 1989 featured several student-led groups amid an outpouring of public support by millions of people from all walks of life in China. One group from Beijing University was led by Shen Tong. Like other student leaders, he was forced to leave China for his personal safety following the deadly June 4th government crackdown. I spoke with Shen Tong to find out more about what the demonstrations and atmosphere were like from inside the student movement.
In the spring of 1989, I was 20 years old. I was a third-year biology student at Beijing University. also known as Peking University, or BEDA as a shorthand.
What was the mood on campus like at that time? How did the discussions of this whole reformation of government start to take place on campus?
Throughout the 1980s, different probably from what people would have imagined today, looking back, is that the college campuses were not so interested in political issues or even public policies beyond kind of normal higher education campus activities. This is pretty much a decade-long opening up of Chinese society and economical liberalization. And as a result of that, our generation is a generation of it's a product of rising expectations in many different areas. This is also moving away from a political era. My group and the Wang Dan's and a couple of other student clubs were in the extreme minority. I mean, my group wasn't focused on politics either. We didn't, none of us, even now, some of my former colleagues from Beida don't consider ourselves political. You know, we were actually interested in lobbying the National Congress and the different ministries for better research environment. When the spring of I arrived, and on April 15th, the news of the death of Hu Yaobang, there's a very strong reaction from campus. People just felt emotionally very engaged. So by that point, my group, the Olympic Institute, and a couple of very small campus groups actually felt we were very opportunistic. We thought this is finally a chance that we can kind of get the attention from the rest of the student body to start to talk about some more issues of public virtue, issues of public policy.
About how large would you say your group was before this turning point?
Yeah, we have about a dozen members, and about seven or eight are pretty active. And we're talking about a couple of people from my dorm and another dorm from across the hallway, no more than a few dozen when we had those gatherings. And a slightly larger group, which also played a very role later on, it's called Democracy Salon. And their biggest event is probably, we're talking about 300-400 students, and that only happened a couple of times.
Was there any sense of perhaps repercussions for speaking out or meeting in your groups at that time?
My group, including myself, didn't think we were really engaging in things similar to what I did in the previous years. We were just engaging in policy and public debate. And how naive were we, you know? And it started turning to protest, and we started to have demands for greater reform. That's when it hit me. I really shouldn't do this to my family, you know, how much worried I've gone through the last three times. And I remember, actually, that's how I got elected, not by putting myself on the ballot. I was there as the representative of the news center to observe the election. And I made the speech after people running the meeting invited me that if you, whoever the candidate might be, ever fancy yourself being the so-called student leader, the main responsibility you should really take and think about is to minimize the damage from the inevitable suppression from the government against the broader student body. And for that reason, there's a rule invented on the spot that people don't have to nominate themselves as a candidate, and for some reason I got elected. So you can see the very conflicting mindset we've had at the time.
You mentioned your family in all this. I can imagine that it must have been a rather difficult time at home at certain periods during this.
My father, who had the misfortune at that time, was working for the Beijing municipal government, which is a frontline defense for the government to defuse, eventually to suppress the student-led protest. And I would want to emphasize, Jim, that the label of student movement is quite inaccurate, because by May, 3-4 weeks later, really all walks of the Chinese society with prolonged large-scale protests, and some estimated 100 to 150 million people. At one of those demonstrations, there wasn't a protest and anger. The atmosphere was rather a carnival and a celebration. There's instances, there's quite bizarre instances where, knowing that quite a few key student activists, organizers, were called back by their family, the government put pressure on the family to basically pull those students out of campus. So for my family, people who are guarding the new center and the dorm room, Building 28, actually escorted, basically blocked my father and escorted him away from the campus to avoid same thing happen to me. And there's also this kind of conflicting mentality of believing we're the true patriots. We really are not against the Communist Party, and we're really not for regime change. We really just want to help the government to reform further in a way that we understand what the reform meant to be, of a greater liberalization, greater freedom. So at the same time, a few of us who experienced suppressions, government oppressions before, somehow intuitively know this will come down badly. So there's that, but also it's the same thing for my family. They were very concerned. By the same time, they're also kind of transcended and proud of the fact that that I was very involved. So that kind of dichotomy, that kind of conflict lasted through the movement, even beyond the June 4th massacre, after I was fortunate to escape China.
Shen Tong, one of the key student leaders from the 1989 pro-democracy demonstrations in China. He spoke with me from New York. Happening now in Asia, Singaporeans got perms and car repairs when the first phase of life after lockdown began. But that will not be enough economic activity to stave off what looks to be the worst recession in that state's history. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Images of violence and looting have dominated news coverage of America's protests against racism and police brutality, but most people participating in the demonstrations have not taken part in the mayhem. VOA's Jusman Oni has this report on how people are making themselves heard without violence.
An emotional visit to the site where it all began. The brother of George Floyd at a makeshift memorial where a white Minneapolis police officer kneeled on his brother's neck, calling for calm and peace in the wake of widespread unrest that has unfolded since Floyd's death.
Let's switch it up, y'all. Let's switch it up.
Yes. Amen.
Do this peacefully. Please.
With U.S. cities in flames following the most widespread protest over police brutality and racism in decades, demonstrators worry their calls for justice are being drowned out by the violence.
George Floyd was killed like an animal, and we're tired. This is the norm. This is not something that's new. It's actually something that's been going on. It's been happening. And we're here just to say that we're tired of this.
The rallies are made up mainly of peaceful demonstrators who greatly outnumber those who want to instigate violence. Yet a number of protests have descended into chaos, usually after sunset, with looting and vandalism. But most demonstrations across the nation have been peaceful, diverse, and unifying.
Black people in this country have never had equal protection under the law. Never. When my adult children go out in the streets wearing a hoodie, I don't have any fear for them. But every mother here fears for her children if they're black children, if they're black men in particular. It is wrong. It is unjust.
Instead of resorting to violence, many protesters are instead finding ways to advance the cause of racial justice, like Matt Manning, a Texas attorney who is offering pro bono services to arrested protesters. He wants his sons to see how he used his skills to support the movement.
If you look at the civil rights movement, people did for the movement what they had the best capacity to do. Some people were feeding everybody as they were planning the movement because their contribution was being able to cook for the movement. Other people, you know, preached. Other people did a number of things. And the capacity I serve in as an attorney, I want to make sure that, you know, when my days are done, I know I did everything I could to help people.
Others are leaning on their faith.
A time to hope.
Writer Christina Pessoa is calling on her multicultural church congregation to action.
As a believer, really grieves me the most is that in a nation that claims to be Christian, that these things really misrepresent God's character. And, you know, I have two Black boys, and one of the very first things that I taught them about who God is that he is just.
But as nonviolent protesters struggle to reclaim the message of these rallies, many say decades of oppression and frustration has led to this violent moment in American history.
A lot of the issues we see are systemic. These are compounded issues, educational system, the housing system, criminal justice, the disparate outcomes for Black and brown people in this country that have existed since the inception of this country.
Systemic issues that will take time to be resolved. Meanwhile, critics say the image of law enforcement breaking up a peaceful rally outside the White House so that Trump could walk to a church will do nothing to help a community seeking justice and healing. Jesusem Elni, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Thousands of furloughed South Korean workers could soon return to their jobs on U.S. military bases in South Korea under the terms of a deal announced by the Pentagon. You'll find this and all the big stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. As protests take place in the United States, indigenous families who have had bad experiences with law enforcement say police brutality is a serious problem in Australia. Aboriginal Australians make up about 3% of the total population, but almost a third of the prison population are indigenous. We hear more from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
David Dungay Jr. died in a prison hospital in Sydney in 2015. After being forcibly moved to an observation cell, restrained face down by guards, and sedated. The incident was captured on video, and the inmate was heard telling staff that he couldn't breathe 10 times. The 26-year-old Australian Aboriginal man eventually lost consciousness and couldn't be revived. For his family, the death of George Floyd many thousands of kilometres away in the US state of Minnesota has brought back traumatic memories. They believe the two men died in similar circumstances, although David Dungay Jr.'s death attracted no international headlines and no formal charges were made. His mother, Letona Dungay, believes George Floyd's death is another example of deep-seated racism.
It was very devastating to look at that too, because of the memory of putting my son in the ground just like they had to put George, their son, in the ground. Black lives do matter, and Aboriginal lives matter. David Jr.'s lives matter.
More than 430 Indigenous Australians have died in custody since a landmark inquiry in the early 1990s. The Royal Commission made sweeping recommendations. Its key finding was the need to reduce the rate at which Aboriginal people are jailed. That hasn't happened. 30% of Australia's prison inmates are Indigenous, as are half of those in youth detention. However, Australia's original inhabitants make up just 3% of the national population. Campaigners have long argued that Aboriginal Australians suffer widespread racism and discrimination. This week, an Australian police officer was filmed tripping up an Aboriginal boy who was then pinned to the ground. Onlookers claim unnecessary force was used, but Assistant Police Commissioner Mick Willing says it wasn't an act of brutality.
I'm concerned that people will use this video, this footage, to create it into something that it's not. As I said, we're all well aware of what's happening overseas, but this is not the United States of America, and we have very, very good relations with our local community.
4 Australian states have Indigenous courts. They abide by Australian law, but allow Aboriginal elders to take part in the process to help create a more culturally sensitive forum for sentencing Indigenous offenders. Researchers say that Aboriginal people have lived in Australia for at least 65,000 years and believe that this predates the human settlement of Europe and the Americas. Their land was colonised by the British in 1788. Despite a rich history and enduring culture, the Aboriginal people suffer high rates of poverty, ill health, and imprisonment. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
How dangerous is COVID-19? 80% of the cases are said to be mild. Young and healthy people are at a relatively low risk. Elderly and people with serious health conditions are at risk of fatality. If you have a cough, fever, and shortness of breath, contact a doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the websites at the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control. A message from your friends at VOA Asia. The cancellation of marathons and major races because of the coronavirus lockdown measures doesn't mean sports lovers can't compete. Racing and breaking records is still possible. It's just a bit more complicated. Maximus Galkov reports.
The coronavirus pandemic and the strict quarantine measures taken by dozens of countries have led to the cancellation and postponement of a myriad of sporting events around the globe. Even the 2020 Summer Olympics in Japan have been pushed back a year. Many sports organizations have suffered enormous financial losses. USA Rugby even filed for bankruptcy, unable to cope with the financial toll of the COVID-19 spread.
Then to have athletes that are simply locked in their houses, not able to train, not able to use public facilities.
For professional tennis player Alla Kudryavtseva, 2020 was supposed to be a big year. She was planning to come back to professional sports after a maternity leave. However, in March, after a series of big tennis tournaments, including Wimbledon, were cancelled, she realized things are very different now. So instead of touring the world, she's staying at home in Boston with her husband and baby daughter.
I'm trying to take this time and just focus on getting physically better. I'm trying not to stress too much about not playing tennis. I'm trying to stay calm and hope for better things to come and to be even better prepared when the situation presents itself.
Professional volleyball player Josiah Byers had to come home to California after a big championship in Greece was cancelled. Now he has next to no chance to properly train.
Like the apartment complex that I'm in, like the gym is closed. So, you know, we don't have that much access to, you know, certain weight trainings that we normally would have in other places. So we have to kind of make our own workouts at home. People who dedicated so much time into their sports, like suddenly just have to stop. And, you know, some people, you know, it was like their last year and now they can't finish it. And so.
However, a lot of sportsmen and women believe the pandemic is not a reason to feel depressed. Famous football players, tennis players, and field athletes start online flash mobs to get in touch with their fans, share their workout routines, and do charity work.
We're sportsmen. We have responsibilities to you because you support us. And now is the time when we cannot fail you. Together with Pau Gasol, we're launching an initiative that will unite all professional athletes and help the Red Cross. Our goal is to raise 11 million euro to help those who suffered from the crisis.
And if the competitive mentality has taught professional athletes anything, they say it's the knowledge that there are no obstacles, just challenges, and that the world will get through it. Maxim Moskalko for VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. You'll also find us on Instagram and YouTube, as well as our voanews.com website. We thank you so much for joining us. We thank our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Popeboon. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day. Be safe. Be well.